Houston Dynamo, Portland Timbers, Sporting Kansas, Los Angeles Galaxy, Beach Pass, this is your home, Toronto FC, Real Salt Lake, this is my red, white, and blue, Chicago Fire, this is my anthem to you, Columbus Crew, FC Dallas, New York Red Bulls.
Pitch Pass, your all-access credential to the people that matter in MLS. Here's your host, Greg Roach.
Week before World Cup, it is a big week in the world of soccer. So big, we need two episodes of Pitch Pass. So couldn't fit everything in the first one, featuring Chad Marshall of Seattle Sounders, Ben Olsen of DC United. Make sure you're downloading that at pitchpass.com if you haven't done so yet. This, the bonus episode this week, and it features our very, very good friend. He covers the Houston Dynamo for Comcast SportsNet Houston, and you can check him out nationally on NBC Sports Network. Sebastian Salazar joins us now. Sebby?
I'm actually in my car. I hope it should be fine, but how's the connection?
It's fine. I just had Olsen on, and he was in his car with the windows down, so it's not going to be any worse than that.
Okay, great. I love how I get bumped for Benny again.
It's nice.
I had to do a pregame hit with TSN Mid-Atlantic when I was there for the DC Houston game.
Yeah.
And they were like, oh, you got to wait a little bit because we're waiting on Ben. And I was like, no, you tell Ben that he's got to wait for Sebastian before the game. See what kind of mood that puts him in.
Dude, it never ends, man. You get away and he's still finding ways to just tweak you a little bit.
Just dog me, man.
How have you been?
Good, man. Real good. It's the turn of the weather down here, so I was outstanding shooting stand-ups in a suit and makeup in like 93 degree weather. So other than that, life is good.
Now, we of course are in the district talking to Sebastian Salazar, and it's hot and humid here as well. That's why the teams are over here, Sebby. They're training in the area to get used to the conditions that they're going to come across in Brazil.
Well, that and to get away from the hordes of media, right?
Well, that as well.
Everybody hates the media.
Spoken as a true media member. Nice work.
I hate myself. Self-loathing.
Where do you want to start? Because we've got a couple of things that are right in Sebastian Salazar's wheelhouse, which is the reason why we had you on. But we could go a couple of different ways. We just mentioned Benny. You want to start with DC United?
Yeah, sure. Having the chance to see them live after having watched, on my little computer MLS live screen for most of the season, I got a real good look at them on a day where they didn't have, arguably their top gun. And I walked away real impressed.
Well, what impressed you? Because for just to get everybody up to speed, if you haven't listened to the Benny portion, make sure you do that at pitchpass.com. I asked him pointedly because after the last match versus Sporting Kansas City, Peter Vermees not very complimentary of the style of play of United. And you and I having worked together on another podcast that was DC United focused. We always talked about grit and bite, and he would always kind of shoot us down and say, no, we don't want to be that team, which is kind of what DC United has turned into. And then so I asked him, I go, is this Benny ball? And he said, no. We go, stylistically, we are not playing where we need to play. Is stylistic important, Sebby, or what impressed you when they played the Dynamo when you happened a chance to see them?
Look, in the big picture, in kind of the abstract, style is very important. I'm sitting right here in Houston in a place where it's a perfect example of why style is important. The Dynamo play in a very competitive media market, as Washington, D.C. is, and they've played this kind of functional soccer for a long time. There's been moments where it's been great, but there's been moments where I think the fans would say it's been dour. There hasn't been that star kind of sexy brand name feel to it or that big name player. And in a lot of ways, it's, I think, hurt the Dynamo in their pursuit of that kind of mainstream, not diehard MLS fan. You don't want that same thing to happen in D.C. You do want to play an attractive ball so you can bring people in. But you're not going to last 3-4 years as a coach in Major League Soccer if you're trying to play some fancy type of ball and you don't have the players to back it up. I think DC United is not just grit. You have attacking players that are really, really good. You've got a Spindola. You've got a guy like Chris Rolfe. You've got, obviously, an Eddie Johnson. And you've got some, workman-like pieces around it that allow those guys to do their thing. I think they play a pretty attractive style of ball. I don't necessarily think it's as grinded out maybe as others do. I was taken aback a little bit by Peter Vermees' comments. I think they were truthfully, if you saw it, it's right as he's walking off the field where he really lays into D.C., there's a bit of frustration there when you lose on the road. But I thought it was a little bit over the top from Vermees to hammer DC United like that. You know, it was a good team effort. They got a win. They beat you on a bit of a fluky goal. I mean, but what do you want the team to do? They're up 1-0. You want them to, you know, fly out of control, chasing a second and third goal to be pretty, and then take a tie at home? That doesn't make sense.
Is it? And I don't mean to put you on the spot because I know I haven't asked you this in advance, so you probably have done zero research on it. But Chris Rolf got to be one of the more underrated best moves of the offseason and early season in MLS.
Well, I had actually forgotten that I did this, but when the MLS reentry draft took place and I was looking at the name, I tweeted something out that was like, hey, the name that immediately jumps out to me is Chris Rolf. I think his number was like 225. And I was like, it's kind of steep, but if you can renegotiate and get him at a bargain, I have a lot of respect for Chris Rolf. I have a buddy that I played college ball with who played club ball for like 6 years with Rolf. And he said, the one thing about Chris Rolf, yes, he's small. Yes, he's hurt all the time, but he can strike a ball as clean as anybody. And that's definitely translated into Major League Soccer. Every year that he's been in MLS, when you watch his technique, if he gets a clean rip, he's going to put it on goal, and it's going to be dangerous. It's going to be trouble for a goalkeeper. I was shocked that nobody took him in the reentry draft. And I think it was a great steal by DC United to land him. And besides the fact that he looks like Mark McClure, which DC United could certainly use a little of, I think he's an awesome, awesome player. Mark's one of our friends here on Pitch Pass.
So let's focus from a team that you used to cover to the team that you cover now in Houston Dynamo. The wheels have come off a little bit, and you know, we talked with Chad Marshall on the episode earlier this week, and we talked about how they were going to adjust to not having their big guns during the World Cup. And, you know, obviously as a player, he's going to say, we've got depth, we've got this. And they're in a situation where they're okay to pick up points or drop points at this stage of the game for the next month or so while they wait for the World Cup to be over. Houston, their guys walked out the door as things were starting to come apart, and since they left, things have really come apart. What's the mood like in Dynamo Land, and how concerned is everyone?
Well, I just sat down with Will Bruin, and he called Friday's game a must-win. He actually used the term must-win twice, which is rare. And there's been some kind of cracks in the armor here, some frustration boiling out. I think we're to the point now where you may start to see some changes real soon in the lineup. I think if there was room under the salary cap to make a move and bring somebody in, they'd be all over it. The reality is this team kind of made a bet. The organization made a bet after the 2012 season to keep this group together and chase a cup last year. It paid off. They made a run to the conference finals and were within 90 minutes of making it back to MLS Cup. The other part of that bet was if you didn't get the MLS Cup, you were going to pay for it this year, and that's what's happening. They're extremely salary cap restricted, and they're not going to be able to really bring anybody in unless they move somebody on. And all of the pieces that are here that another team might want are pretty valuable here. So I don't know that there's really a fix, and when you get that sense that there's not a fix, you start to feel some of the frustration. It has really fallen apart. You have to look at midfield. You've lost three world-class players. No Brad Davis, no Boniek Garcia, and no Ricardo Clark. Ricardo Clark has missed 8 straight games with a concussion. I mean, it's starting to get to the point now, and the team is being very, very tight-lipped about it. But this is a real serious concern. I don't want to use the word career because that'll throw everybody into a panic. But, you miss 8 straight games because of a concussion, and that's real. That's a real serious issue for Ricardo Clark personally, beyond what it means to the Houston Dynamo. You replace those three guys in the middle of the park with a Warren Cravall and a Servando Carrasco, who have both shown flashes of being, capable fill-in players. But at the end of the day, that's what they are. They're role players. You look at their salaries, you compare them to the salaries of the guys who have left, and it's a major drop-off. And sometimes in MLS, you get what you pay for. So to assume that the Dynamo could absorb these types of absences and then rely on these younger, cheaper players, I think was a bit of a gamble. And right now it's a gamble that's not paying off.
You know, and I talked with Chad Marshall talked with Ben Olsen both about the break due to World Cup. United doesn't have as much of a break. Ben said that's good as a coach. As a player, he would probably want a break. Seattle has a break. But I feel like even in the situation of Dynamo, who do have a significant little gap between matches, even if you throw in the U.S. Open Cup matches, I don't know, what do you work on during that break that you can then say, okay, this is going to start changing the tide? Break or no break, I don't know if that's a good situation for them.
Yeah, I think when I heard the comments today about the urgency about the Sporting Kansas City game, I think what they realize is there's not a whole lot you can work on in a break. Really what you're doing with this group is waiting.
Yeah.
You're waiting for Brad Davis to get back. You're waiting for Rico to get back. You're waiting for Boniek to get back. Now, you can try and find a lineup that'll hold you over, but really, that time has come and gone, Greg. It's come and gone. It was the last three games that you needed to figure that out and scrape out a road point in San Jose or Colorado and maybe get a win in one of those games, maybe pick up a point or a win in D.C. Instead, they get outscored 8-0 and take 0 points from those three road games. It was a really, really difficult road trip, and that was the stretch where you needed to have had whatever the kind of plan B was going to be figured out. At this point, the break doesn't really help you, because by the end of the break, in theory, you've got everybody back, and you can go about business as they did at the beginning of this month. It wasn't all that long ago. Early May, they won 3 out of 4. So there is some quality here. It was most of the same guys, except for those big pieces in the most important part of the field.
It's not a must-win in the must-win situation, or the your typical "hey, we lose, we're out" kind of situation. But it is a must-win, as Will Bruin told you. Is it a must-win because for the confidence build? Is it a must-win because you're facing a Sporting Kansas City team that not only is probably your biggest arch rival outside of FC Dallas, but also a team that's basically bringing in their B/C team, and you just need to say, hey, look, we still have the talent to beat teams that are not on their game? Why is this a must-win game for Houston at its core?
I think the real truth of it is there may be some changes here if they don't win.
Are you intimating coaching changes when you keep saying
no,
this?
No. Dominic Kinnear is as good as it gets. Ain't nobody in this league going to get more out of a group, going to squeeze more blood out of a stone than Dominic Kinnear. That's not what I'm saying. But one of the things that has made the Dynamo so successful is that they keep groups together. There's not a lot of change. But at some point, when the expectations are as high as they are here in Houston, if you're losing 8 games, like they've lost 8 games already, that didn't happen until the end of August last year. At some point, you have to look at your roster and say, we've got to make a change. And I'm telling you, there's no salary cap room. The only way to make a change is to make a trade. So if these guys want to keep this group together, they've got basically one last chance before this huge long layoff, where there's going to be a lot of talk about potential changes and trades and all that stuff around MLS. So I think that's where the pressure comes from. It comes from, we're running out of time to convince Dom and the management of this team that this physical roster, this group that we have, can compete and make the playoffs, as is the standard here in Houston, in a very, very crowded Eastern Conference.
And no one wants to spend a month, coaches, players, even you as a media member, asking and answering the question of what's going wrong for a month.
Of course. Especially when you're dealing with 95-degree heat and, you know, wearing makeup and suit in the heat of Houston. Nobody wants to do that. And these guys, there's a lot of tension around this team right now. They are unaccustomed to dry spells like this. And hey, this isn't their first of the year. Remember, they went 6 games winless after winning their first two. So this has been a very Jekyll and Hyde, up and down Houston Dynamo team. The thing that they can always go back to.
And by the way, what you're about to say was going to be my next question as an outsider looking at the Houston Dynamo. So go ahead and say it.
They've been here before.
Exactly.
They've struggled. They've gone up. They've gone down. Yes. But you can't always count on that. And the Eastern Conference has not always been what it is this year. I believe it to be much stronger and much deeper. I think there are 7 or 8 playoff quality teams possibly in the East right now. And if the Dynamo want to be one of the five that actually make it, they got to start making up points in a hurry.
Okay, because that was going to be my question, and you may have answered it. If you have something to tack on, then just say, I've got more to tack on, Roach. But as a guy who's living outside of Houston, what's to keep me from just going, yeah, Houston's struggling. All right, let's wait till this 95-degree heat comes and BBVA Compass turns into a cauldron, literally a cauldron, and teams start wilting down there. And next thing you know, it's September, and they're sitting in the sixth slot for the playoffs. And the next thing you know, they're in the conference finals again. Why is this year different?
I can't tell you that it's going to be different. I thought last year there was a chance they wouldn't make the playoffs. Look, they made it last year, let's not forget, on the last day of the regular season by beating the worst MLS team by most metrics of all time and getting some help. Yes, they made the conference finals for the third straight year, but they were within 45 minutes of not making the playoffs last year. So I think when you add it all up, you know, there's a real shot in MLS. This Dynamo team is good enough if they get into the playoffs to make some noise. But they've been right on that line of not making the postseason each of the last 2 years. And you can't discount that. Yes, they have the history of picking themselves out. But these guys are all a year older, right? In 2011, 2012, everybody was a year younger. Everybody was a year fitter. And I don't know, as I've said, with this salary cap, that this team has taken the strides to get better over the last year. They've maintained the group as is, hoping that, you know, kind of like the San Antonio Spurs in basketball, they're right there. If you keep the group together, we're going to be right there again. It's worked out. This may be the year that they pay the Pipers. Now,
perfect name to transition from Houston Dynamo, MLS, World Cup, USA, Brad Davis. When we talked in the fall, and I don't think that your opinion or my opinion was a dissenting opinion, Brad Davis needed to do a lot to get on the plane to Brazil. He got on that plane to Brazil. What did he do?
You know what? What he did was he looked at the criteria set before him. Jurgen Klinsmann allowed a guy like Brad Davis to have a hope, to have a dream. He said, look, we're going to do it off form. We're going to do it off play. We're going to do it off how you fit in the group, what you do in the camp. And every single opportunity in camp, in training, Brad Davis seems to have taken advantage of. I think the last month and a half run-up to the U.S. call, to the camp call, he was great. I mean, the last four games that Brad Davis played after that ankle injury, I talked to a few people that have been around him since 06, 07, and they all said it's the best we've ever seen Brad Davis play. Klinsmann said he was going to make his team based off that. He'd allowed a guy like Brad Davis to have hope. Brad was extremely confident. When we went to interview him at his house the day of the 30-man roster, I said, hey, man, congratulations. Well, sort of congratulations. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, you know, there's only 23 guys going. And he's like, I'm going. And I was, you know, he was like, well, you can still congratulate me. Like, I was like, okay, all right. Like, it offended him, I thought. And look, Brad Davis went into that camp, earned a spot, and now all of a sudden
yes.
He's starting against Turkey. So, I mean, this guy has made a huge jump in the last, if we're looking back really 12 to 18 months, and even in the last 6 months. So he was one of the top 14 guys in theory. When they played in Azteca, he got into that game against Mexico, so he was already pretty high up the ladder then.
Yeah, but you just said it. I mean, Klinsmann's first little peek set at what maybe he's thinking of doing against Ghana, Brad Davis is a major part of that little peek.
It's wild to think about it. It really is. But look what Brad does. He doesn't make mistakes. He keeps possession. He's got something that nobody else on that team has, right? He's got this left foot. He's got this great ability on set pieces. In many ways, any coach would want somebody with those qualities on a team. Even 2 months ago, I was saying there was no chance for Brad. But I really think if you look at what he's done, I don't know. There's so many questions when you look at Klinsmann's list.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think you can really make a case for why Brad's there.
If it was just a matter of the left foot, which is all we hear about, and the left foot and the set pieces, do you think that he's competing for a starting place? And if the answer is no, what else did he decide or is now bringing to the table other than those two assets that has made him somebody that can be considered for the starting 11?
Well, to say it's just the left foot is to drastically oversimplify things, and it's really a disservice to Brad. When I see Brad playing with the Houston Dynamo and he's playing in the middle of the park, he's pinging the ball around. There's a lot of movement off the ball. He's doing defensive work. He's covering a lot of ground, things that we don't give Brad Davis credit for because early Brad Davis didn't do those things. Yeah. May have turned his nose up at those things. But that's 06, 07, 08 Brad Davis. You know, 2011, 2012, 2013 Brad Davis is a far more complete player. And I think all you need to know about what Brad Davis is, plug in the last few games where he's playing with the Dynamo, and then plug in the games against that Houston's playing against San Jose and Colorado and watch the midfield. I mean, they were just got outpossessed by Colorado 60-40. Colorado. It's not Barcelona. It's Colorado. That's what Brad Davis does. Brad Davis allows you to maintain possession, allows you to be dangerous. He can maintain possession in tight quarters. In the final third where goals are created, he's a guy who can ping it quick, one, two touch. Even now we're seeing at that high-speed international level. So don't oversimplify and say, oh, he's just got left foot, bending it in, set pieces, corner kicks. There's a lot more to Brad's game than what there was 5-6 years ago when people were starting to form their opinions on Brad Davis.
Let's look south of the border, Sebi.
Do we have to?
We do have to because that's the third reason why we brought you in. We not so much talking about U.S. We've done a lot of that in the last few episodes of Pitch Pass. But you're the guy that we need to speak to about Mexico, especially to a Mexican neophyte like myself. How do they look in that loss to Bosnia, first off?
Well, so here's my take on the Bosnia game. You know, I'm on Twitter just like everybody else as I'm watching it. And after the game, I see this, like, overwhelmingly negative reaction to Mexico's performance. And, look, the first 15 minutes were very difficult. Mexico looked unorganized. They truthfully looked unprepared. There's lots of talk afterwards about how the Bosnians had changed their lineup and that had thrown the Mexicans off in their preparation in terms of marking. I kind of buy into that. I don't really care. You got to be ready to play no matter who's out in the 11. And if you tell me the Mexican players knew all about Bosnia's starting lineup, that they were that well scouted, I'll roll my eyes at you anyway. That's not why they looked unorganized, or not the entire reason they didn't look good in the first 15, 20 minutes. Bosnia's a really good team. The first half could have ended 2-0, 3-0. When a team gets up on you, when they have the better play, you need to find a way to react to it. I think the reaction from Mexico came a little bit late. The changes tactically from Herrera were not until halftime. I ideally would have liked to see them 15, 20 minutes in when you see yourself starting to get hammered and the field tilt towards your goal. I thought in the second half, Mexico was lively. I thought they were really moving the ball at a speed that I have not seen this Mexican team move it in a long, long time. Certainly dating all the way back into qualifying through all the coaching changes. In all the time that Herrera's been the coach, I've not seen them move the ball, not just that quickly, but that quickly and that dangerously, especially in the final third towards goal, creating chances. I was really uplifted as a Mexico fan, supporter, somebody that follows the team, at those last 45 minutes. To do it that quickly against a team of that quality, I think Bosnia is a fairly good team. I thought there was a lot of positives to take. But look, at the end of the day, we really don't know what Mexico is. That's what killed him in qualifying. There's no consistency within this group. And until you find a guy that's going to score some goals, which, again, there is not right now, Oribe Peralta would seem to be the guy. Chicharito can't find the back of the net to save his life. God bless him. He's trying. He's coming close, but it's not working. You know, they're going to have to find a guy to score some goals because until you get goals, whatever else you do is irrelevant. You can have dominate possession as Mexico does, slow on the wrong side of midfield, but it's not going to get it done. It's not going to get it done against Cameroon, who can counterattack it. It's not going to get it done against Croatia, who can pick you apart with lots of quality in their attacking third. It's definitely not going to get it done against Brazil.
Let me ask you a question about mentality. And it's a kind of a, you can answer it both ways if you could. As supporters, as Mexicans, the people of Mexico, and then, of course, the team and the federation and the setup. How hard is it Or is it hard, or is it an adjustment to go from basically throughout the course of 4 years to always feel like whatever competitive match we're in, we're going to be favored to win, maybe outside of one match against USA in USA, to going into a World Cup where they kind of are always the underdog, or they have to assume this underdog mentality? Do they assume that mentality, and how hard is it of an adjustment to go from the king of the big fish in the small pond to the small fish in the big pond?
You know, I think there's this weird double-edged sword with Mexican soccer. There's an arrogance that has been chipped away at a lot. A lot of that arrogance comes from dominating CONCACAF for so long. But now when you start to lose to the United States, and certainly when you start to have some of the results that they had in this last qualifying round, that ego has been dramatically, dramatically cut into. I think we have to be, you know, totally honest about that. Mexico's last two World Cup groups were very, how do I say this, serviceable, right? You could get through those last two groups. In 06, they played Portugal in the last game, but they had already gone through. You know, they beat Iran and then tied Angola. I mean, that's an easy group. That's as easy as you're going to get in a World Cup. 2010, you get the host, South Africa, and then you get a dysfunctional French team before you face Uruguay. So they've had groups where they can survive. I think this group is a little bit like that, though tougher. This is probably the toughest group that Mexico has had. I'd go back to since I've been alive. I mean, I don't know that they've had a tougher group than this. So this is really the first time, if you combine the quality of the group and the total lack of confidence built through qualifying, where Mexico really, really is truly an underdog. The goal for Mexico is always to get to that fifth game. It hasn't happened since 86. It's only happened twice, and both those times were on home soil. That's the kind of goal, you know, that's the end-all be-all for Mexico, is this fifth game. And, you know, when your realistic hope is only to get to the quarterfinals, how big of a fish are you? I mean, you have to know your place, and it is that, look, if we have a great run, we get to the final eight, and that's about it.
Is Croatia the key match for their tournament?
No, Cameroon is. Cameroon is, because I think you can beat, I think if you're Mexico, if you're going to get out of this group, you have to beat Cameroon. If you don't beat Cameroon, I don't really see a way out. You know, I don't think you're good enough then to say you're one of the top 16 teams in the world. And the second game being against Brazil, though Mexico has a history, remember this, of playing very well against Brazil. That matchup, those two styles, usually end in close, very attractive games. Mexico will every once in a while sneak a tie, maybe pull out a win. They won't win in the World Cup against Brazil. But there is a chance that you lose that. There's a very good chance you lose that second game to Brazil. If you don't already have 3 points in the bag from Cameroon,
good point,
you're in trouble. So, of course, the last game against Croatia is probably what mathematically will decide it. But I don't think if you don't come out with 3 points from the game against Cameroon, I think your fate may be done and dusted by the time you get to the third game.
And you talked about the prior groups for Mexico and how this one is tougher. Really, you couldn't have asked for a worse of the three slots to play Brazil than that second slot.
Of course, of course. If you get them in the third game, you might be getting a watered down Brazil.
Yes, and if you get them in the first game and you get that loss, you still have two matches to then recover and pick up your points. That second match, though, it just comes at the worst possible time that it'd be Brazil.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, at the end of the day, you could argue: is there any good time to play Brazil in Brazil in a World Cup?
True.
It's going to be a mountain, no matter for second, third, fourth, fifth game, whenever you meet them. So Mexico is an overwhelming underdog in that game, regardless of when it's played. But, yeah, I see what you're saying. You know, I think the first game might be tougher, too, because of all of the adrenaline. And I think Brazil is the type of team that, especially in that first game, before it really becomes pressure, when they get the adrenaline of being at home going and they're zipping around confident, they can really – I mean, they can hammer you.
True.
They can beat you 3-4-0, especially a team like Mexico. That's what I would say maybe worries me the most I could see Mexico getting run off the field against Brazil.
So I know hardcore soccer fans are going to roll their eyes at my question to you, but I'm asking a question because I don't know the answer to it. And just like, you know, sports fans who don't know a lot about soccer are shocked about Landon Donovan, I have to ask you about Chicharito. Is his place is not assured in the starting 11? Is that what I'm to believe now?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. You can't look. It's interesting, right? Because there's kind of a similar situation.
Yes.
You could compare Josie and Chicharito very similarly, right? Two guys who my eyeball, my gut tells me they're great players, or they're good players. They ought to be in the starting 11. But the performances, the paper in the last 12 months tells me maybe I ought to reconsider that. But the coaches are two different animals. Jurgen Klinsmann really values Europe. He respects Europe in a way that Miguel Herrera does. Miguel Herrera wants Mexican guys who are committed, who play in Liga MX, who sweat it out on Saturdays in the heat of Mexico and know what those kind of grinded out games are about. That really, for whatever reason, right or wrong, you know, this play for the shirt. You know, it's kind of abstract and idealistic, and I don't buy into it. But Miguel Herrera likes guys who play and perform and deliver results in the Mexican league. He puts a lot of weight in that. At the end of the day, that's where he's coached. That's what he's watched. Oribe Peralta has done that through and through, has delivered. In Liga MX, has been one of the best forward, consistent goal-scoring threats. Chicharito has not. And so I think Peralta, for that reason, is a bit ahead of Hernandez. There's the talk that maybe you could start both together, but I don't see it. I don't see, with all of the lineups that I've seen from Herrera, I don't see that playing out. It just doesn't seem to work for me. And if you've got to pick one or the two, I would maybe pick Chicharito. But I know exactly what Herrera's going to do, and he's going to pick Oribe because that's the guy he trusts. That's the guy he leaned on when he took the team over. And that's the way he built the team. He built the team out of guys he could call into camp, see every week, rely on, and know what he was going to get. And that's Peralta over Hernandez right now. It just is.
So if you had to put money down, you would say no Chicharito in that first match versus Cameroon to start the World Cup for Mexico?
I do. I do not think he will start in the first game. I do think he will start at some point.
Got it.
I think Herrera's kind of like Klinsmann, a bit of a wild card. He's not the type of manager, I don't think, to throw out three identical starting 11. And maybe Chicharito is such a option off the bench that we see him early, right? If Benalta's not clicking right off the top against Cameroon, maybe you see a sub at the half. Herrera's been known kind of for a quick hook on guys, so keep an eye on that too. Maybe you don't start, but you play just as much if you play that second 45.
Second question, Mexico get out of the group.
Man, no. Look, they've never, since I've been alive, basically, they've never not made it out of the group. But like I said, this is the toughest group. Cameroon's there to be had. I think Croatia's on another level, man. You got Luka Modric started for Real Madrid in the Champions League final. To me, that means he's one of the best 15, 20 players in the world. Mexico doesn't have a guy like that, you know? And it's those players oftentimes in these games that either on their own create something or draw so much attention that their unheralded supporting cast steps up and makes plays for them. I think he's the type of guy that really unlocks Mexico. Croatia worries me. I don't think they get past Croatia. I don't think they get a positive result against Brazil. I could see them getting out of the group phase with 0 points, maybe with three. Four's a big ask, and it may take more than four to qualify. So I don't, if I'm really being honest, I don't think Mexico goes through.
Okay, so if that's what you think, and we all have our opinions on the U.S., you got Honduras looking horrible in their build-up to Brazil.
I think Honduras is sandbagging. I think Honduras is sandbagging. Look, I think they've got a foxy Latin American coach who's trying to throw people off.
Okay.
If you look at what they did against Israel, they didn't start anybody. They didn't have Izaguirre. They didn't have Palacios. They didn't have Andy Nahar. They didn't have Fonya Garcia. They didn't start anybody. So I don't know that. I think Honduras is sandbagging it.
All
and
right.
I think they could be a surprise. That group is there for the take.
Exactly.
For that second place spot.
And that's their upside. Costa Rica losing Alvaro Salvarillo. You know, if everything falls wrong, and it's not too hard to envision things falling wrong, this could be a disastrous World Cup for CONCACAF.
It's funny. I was just talking to Jermaine Taylor, center back for Jamaica, plays here for the Dynamo, and he was telling me, yeah, that his rooting interest when it comes to the World Cup is primarily CONCACAF. Like, he'll just down the line root for whatever CONCACAF teams are in it. And he told me that, man, there's going to be a struggle for any of these CONCACAF teams to get out of the group phase, basically because of the groups that they're in. Honduras probably has the best group. Some people would say that maybe they're the weakest of the four. I actually think Honduras is a pretty darn good team when they're clicking, when they're really on, which, as you mentioned, we haven't seen of late. The Costa Rica, the injury to Salvarillo hurts a lot, and they've had some other injuries, too, that have really changed who they are as a team with Oviedo going out. So I don't know. Costa Rica, to me, is in a tough group. Mexico's in a brutal group, and the United States in the toughest group of all. So the matchups, more than the quality of soccer, I think is what's going to doom CONCACAF in this World Cup.
And the last thing before I ask you something else that people might want to tune out for if they're just here for the soccer talk, who do you have winning?
Germany. I don't know that they'll win, but I think if this World Cup was played 10 times, they'd probably win 4 or 5. So I think Germany's my pick. I've got Germany and Argentina in the final. That Argentina pick is more hopeful than really belief.
Yeah.
They have zero defense, issues in midfield, goalkeeping insecurities. But I would love to see Argentina in a final. I think having Messi playing on that stage would be really fun to watch. And then I've got Brazil and Spain in the third place game.
You know what's weird? I did the brackets that our friend Mark McClure, who you brought up, put together at MLSsoccer.com. And, you know, I just did it based on how I felt about game by game. I ended up with Brazil versus Belgium in the final. And
Belgium.
And it was weird. But, you know, if they get out of the group, again, you talked about all Argentina's problems. I had them beating Argentina. So really the upset match would be Spain. So beating Spain would be the huge hurdle, the shocker for Belgium. But everything up till that point, including beating Argentina, isn't that much of a struggle to get my head around them winning that game. I have them losing to Brazil, but that, you know, that's just something to think about. I put Belgium going far.
Yeah, Belgium is a lot of people's dark horse.
It's sexy.
And with good reason, man. I mean, they're loaded with kind of that next-level, world-class, game-changing talent. That's the reality. So many teams in this tournament just don't have that. There are probably 6 to 8 that do. And if you're one of those 6 to 8, you're in this other class, to me anyway, as far as, you know, what I expect from teams. And I think Belgium is one of those teams that has the potential, the players on paper, which is not where soccer's played, but the potential on paper to kind of take over a game just because of their individual quality.
So we thank everybody for downloading the episode of Pitch Pass. Thank you very much, pitchpass.com, if you want to get more episodes. I wanted to ask Sebi a cultural question. So if you don't feel like hearing about non-soccer stuff, feel free to stop the episode right now. But, you know, as I hear you beautifully pronouncing all of the Mexican players' names, something that I always wanted to ask a Spanish speaker. First off, if you go to Mexico, Sebi, would they know that you are not a born and raised Mexican?
Yes.
They would know.
Yes. My Spanish has a very Argentine accent.
And that was my question was going to ask you, is what kind of accent do you have then?
Yeah. It's weird. My two best friends are Argentine, and I played on a men's league team for the longest time, and all the guys on it were either Argentine or Uruguayan, and both of those accents are very specific and very similar. So, my Spanish does not actually sound like your typical Mexican Spanish. It's much more Argentine. So they would know that. But yeah, I think other than that, they would just think whenever I go to Mexico, they always ask me like, where in Buenos Aires are you from?
Oh, that's
so
funny.
So it's weird, right? Nobody would assume that, but yeah. And I kind of look like a little bit of a gringo too. My dad's American.
Now, when you tell them that you're actually you can trace your lineage back to Mexico, do they roll their eyes and go sell out?
No, man. You know, a little bit probably, a little bit. But so, I'm a half breed, so my mom's Mexican, my dad's American. I have kind of the split loyalties. But yes, they do always, my cousins don't get it. I'm like, I'm a huge Mexico fan. You know this, right? Whenever the U.S. beats Mexico, I get these like hate mail from my cousins about how like Mexico's being kept out of the World Cup by the U.S., which obviously turned very dramatically when the U.S. then got Mexico into the World Cup. But they're like, they forget all of the times that we've watched Mexico get together and been like crazy about it. And they're just like, oh, you gringo scum, this and that. But yeah, you know, people forget quickly, even family.
Okay, but here's the actual question. Because I'm always fascinated with, and I asked somebody this, and I said, hey, is somebody from Spain who speaks Spanish, is that like hearing, like as an American, is it like hearing an Englishman speak with that proper, highbrow English? Is it the same way when people from Latin America hear people from Spain speak Spanish? And the answer was yes, of course. Do you agree with that first off?
No. I think Spanish, especially if spoken by like a Spanish woman, is beautiful. Like, don't get me wrong, but it doesn't, to me, I've never equated it with like highbrow as I do the English accent.
Okay. Okay.
You know, the Queen's English,
yes,
or whatever.
Yes.
And I say this as somebody who speaks kind of with that accent, like Argentine Spanish to be a little bit like, pompous, you know, or like, I don't know. I think you just kind of equate it with your experiences with, you know, people from whatever part of the world. If you ever had a Brit look down his nose at you, then you think, oh yeah,
yeah,
the English accent is kind of hoity-toity.
So who is the what country is the Spanish speaking equivalent of American English?
Of American English.
Now I say that because, you know,
Greg, because there's so many different Spanishes. Whereas
true.
In English, how many Englishes are there?
Maybe three,
I mean,
four.
I guess you got Australian,
yeah.
You got South African, you got the Kiwis. You got a little bit. Yeah, I mean, there's five or six, right?
Yes.
So when you ask that, are you saying American English is like the dumbed down English?
No, because you would think that. But, you know, when you talk to people like linguists, they'll tell you that that American English is actually the true, like the best spoken English when done by the right person, not with a trashy Philadelphia accent like myself or somebody from the South. But like a true straight down the middle, maybe Midwestern English accent is the quintessential version of English.
I think there's a really nice kind of regional dialect that comes from northern Mexico that's kind of sing-songy. And then, truthfully, Argentine and Uruguayan Spanish just has like a roll and a musical feel to it, very sing-songy. Colombian, honestly, I'm just naming countries where I've heard good-looking women speak with that dialect. So, I don't know if this is based in anything real, Greg.
Well, you know what's funny? So this all started for me years ago. I was dating a girl, blonde hair, blue eyes, very attractive, and she spoke Spanish. And I always liked when she spoke Spanish because I thought it was sexy. She speak another language. And so I had another buddy, and he spoke Spanish. So they had a whole conversation, and we walked away, and I said to my friend, I go, how hot is it that she speaks Spanish? And he goes, yeah, but she speaks with like a Chilean accent, and it's really trashy sounding.
Yeah, no, I don't find any accent. Well, I won't admit to finding any trashy, any accent trashy. I don't want to.
There is, but Sebi will not say.
Sometimes you got to be a politician about this stuff.
Well,
yeah.
I will say, though, I wasn't the one who said that the Chilean accent was trashy. I'm just saying my friend said the Chilean accent on this blonde-haired, blue-eyed white girl was trashy.
Yeah, but you know what? A lot of that could be based on his experience. There's tons of rivalries, and we're going to see this play out in the World Cup to kind of bring it back to soccer.
Nice.
There's a lot of rivalries in Latin America, and they're very nasty and ugly and tribal. And, like, you know, I was talking to my buddy from Argentina, and he was explaining to me the kind of hatred between Brazil and Argentina. And it's not just like, oh, Canada, U.S., or like,
yeah,
U.S., Mexico, we're kind of friendly. It's like deep and rooted in like a lot of cultural insecurities and arrogance on both sides. And so those rivalries are really kind of maybe what make somebody say, oh, I don't like the Chilean accent, or I don't like the Argentine accent, or I don't like, it's kind of, oh, well, I think they're conceited, so I don't like their accent. It sounds conceited to me. And you watch, the like, there's a couple potential matchups in this World Cup, like a Colombia-Uruguay in the second round, that if those games get played, they are going to be so heated. It's going to be awesome.
Why is it hard, and this will be the last thing before we sign off, why is it hard for European teams to play in South America? They didn't seem to have much trouble when they played in the States, so I can't really just pin it on heat and humidity. What's the difference from European to South American climates, weather, whatever, that makes it hard for European teams to travel down there?
Well, look.
And is it overrated now? Because a lot of...
It is overrated. What was the last World Cup in Latin America? 78, Argentina, right?
Yeah.
So, and Holland made the final there. So, they were okay. I guess my, you know, travel and facilities and understanding of how to manage all that stuff has come so far from the 70s. Guys were smoking cigarettes at that time of 78 World Cup games, right?
True.
So I think we're going to see some European teams do well in this. I think that is a bit overrated. But maybe it's not about the European teams playing poorly. Maybe it's about the Latin American teams playing better.
Yes.
I've always said this. It was one of the big things that kept Mexican soccer back for a long time. The best Mexican players in the 80s and 90s, they weren't leaving Mexico, not because they weren't good enough to play in Europe, maybe, but because Mexico was so good that the quality of life for a professional player in Mexico was so great. Living in Mexico is awesome. The food is incredible. Everything's great. You're just so much more comfortable there. And I think that's something you see with these Latin American players. Comfort means a lot to them. So when they're comfortable, their level goes up. Maybe it's not so much about the European team having their level drop.
We gave people 45 minutes of bonus pitch pass this week. Thank you, Sebi. I appreciate you coming on, and best of luck to both of your teams in the World Cup.
Awesome. Yeah, man. Anytime. You know, I love doing it. And it would be great for soccer in this country if both Mexico and the U.S. advance. And at the end of the day,
agreed.
Whatever side of the rivalry you're on, I think you got to root for both, because we really are tied together now. It's no longer Mexico's the big dog and the U.S. is hacking away at that. It's 1 and 1A. It's going to flip over the years. But if the U.S. and Mexico are going to carry the flag for this region, we really need both to succeed.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it.
Anytime. Later on, man.
H-Pass.
This is your voice. This is my red, white, and blue. This is my anthem to you.
For more show information, go to pitchpass.com.